As mentioned, my name is Peter Payne. I have very long roots here in Mount Hermon. My grandparents bought property here in 1910, and my dad used to spend summers here in Mount Hermon as a kid. So back when the early days of Mount Hermon, and my grandmother was best friends with a couple of the children of the founders of Mount Hermon. I first came out as either 50 or 51. My mom was trying to remember whether I came out when I was only a month old, because I was born in the month of May, whether they skipped that summer. They might have skipped that summer. So I have long roots here in Mount Hermon. I was 3 years on summer staff, 68, 69, and 70. The last one, 70, I was a counselor at Ponderosa. In terms of the history of Ponderosa, its first summer was 1969. Due to the vision of Bill Gwynn and just the marvelous impact that Ponderosa has had ever since. So I love this place, and I love being able to give seminars. My own training is in philosophy. I have a PhD in philosophy from Claremont. You can ask me about it later, but the topic was design in the universe, the design argument from the perspective of natural law. So looking at the laws of physics, and why do they seem fine-tuned for the possibility of life? So very different topic than what I'm dealing with today. So if you've been in the past to hear seminars, sometimes there are science and faith kinds of topics, which I love addressing because that's the biggest issue that most secular people have with the Christian faith. The science tells us that we live in a totally natural world. There's nothing supernatural. God doesn't exist. So that's a passion of mine, communicating and talking to them. But I also do a fair amount of speaking with a lot of different topics. And this one I mentioned up front, I've given several times in Europe. One time was in this last spring, was in Luleå, which is far northern Sweden, only 50 kilometers from the Arctic Circle. There were about 25 students there, five of whom were Christians, all the rest non-Christians. And given that it's Sweden, my assumption was that most of them were sleeping with their boyfriends or girlfriends. So the talk afterwards, the several questions were around, well, you've given examples from American studies, the studies with Americans, but what about cross-cultural studies? And I didn't sort of say this to them, but I know the back of their mind was, well, we're Swedes. And we've been at this longer than Americans have been at it, and we can handle it. We're quite okay with this sex before marriage thing. And so, but anyway, it was really fun interacting with them, and I love the topic. So let me just mention, I'll try to mention at the end, there's a clipboard at the back. If you'd like to get the PowerPoint, you put your name and your email address down there. I'll also keep you updated on things that the Institute for Credible Christianity does. That's the nonprofit that my wife and I started back in 2008. So we've been traveling actually since before then. I was on staff with the University Christian Fellowship, going over to Europe every year. So this last spring was our 19th trip to Europe by invitation from the Christian student movements there. And we actually live here in Mount Hermon. I'm not full-time staff with Mount Hermon, but do seminars for them during the summertime and just really enjoy the opportunity to do it. So it's a wide range of interests and topics. And this is one which I think is particularly important because a lot of Christian young people either intentionally or unintentionally or slip into or decide to have sex, and then they justify their own mind. And if they realize the Christian faith doesn't approve of what they're doing, that gives them reason to distance themselves from the faith. And in terms of why people leave the faith, I suspect there are probably quite a few, actually, that the most significant reason is they've made choices sexually that they've convinced themselves are right. And since the Christian faith must therefore be wrong, have moved away from it. Well, if we could persuade such individuals that in fact the biblical view on sexuality, even in secular terms, makes very good sense, it would guess give less fuel for their motivation for saying, well, this is why leaving the Christian faith makes sense. I'll say a little bit more about the practical side. At the end, when I give this talk in Luleå, I said that even if you agree with the things I've said in this talk, I think there's a very good chance you won't heed it. And there are reasons for that. So understanding the why of biblical sexuality, when I gave it up there, it was why does God want to limit our sexuality? Why would God be so unreasonable as to want to limit our sexuality? I want to start off with a question, and you can turn to someone next to you. And the question is, suppose someone said the following: the Christian ethic of sex only in marriage is an ethic that used to make sense. It made sense because having sex entailed the serious possibility that a woman might get pregnant. And it is important that children be born into a setting where they will be wanted and cared for by their parents. But with effective birth control, the sex only in marriage ethic no longer makes sense. So turn to someone next to you, and how would you respond to someone who says this? For those of you who just came in, we're talking about this, but I also mentioned just a few minutes ago, there's a clipboard in the back with a sign up. And if you'd like to get the PowerPoint, just put your name down there and your email. I'll also give you updates on the ministry that my wife and I are involved in. If you want to get off that at any point, you're welcome to be off of that, or you can even say on there, don't put me on the ongoing updates. They don't come very often, but I do keep people updated on our trips to Europe and that kind of thing. There's also some flyers back there of this trip we took to Europe last year. It was almost 10 weeks, leaving end of February and coming back on May 4th. So it gives an itinerary of the various places we went, topics, and then some discussion of the things that are there. So I'll give you a little bit of idea of the things that my wife and I do. Okay, you probably talk more about this. What are some of the responses? How would you respond to that comment?
Well, nature seems to teach that sex outside of marriage brings on STDs.
All right, so there's the whole problem of sexually transmitted diseases. Which, interesting enough, the studies have said most young people don't take that very seriously. Somehow they think they'll be safe from it. But no, that's a serious consideration. I mean, if you're a secular person, how much is it worth to you, the significant chance that you'll get a disease that you have to keep fighting for the rest of your life? No? Sure, it's fun, but how much is that worth? But in response to this, the person can say, well, okay, we're working on that. We'll assume that past that, then surely this old standard no longer makes sense. Although it's true, if you wait until you get married, you won't be transmitting sexual diseases if you haven't had sex with somebody before then. That's just a no-brainer. Yes?
Yeah, we were talking about the emotional bonds that are formed in a sexual relationship.
Right.
And that it can damage those either by distraction from the other aspects of a relationship. So do we actually get along? Well, the sexual draw is just so emotionally exciting that it takes away from actually getting to know the person. And then also when that breaks, just a diminishing return on that bond being formed with sex.
Right. And actually, it's not, I mean, just not just that it's fun, but there's actually a biochemical hormone, which I'll come back to in a moment, that when you're engaged in affectionate behavior and the lead up to sex and having sex itself, sort of the maximum amount when this hormone gets released, and actually the effect of it is to build an emotional bond. So just biologically, there's more to it than simply the question of whether you're going to have a baby coming from it. Any other reflections? Yeah.
We have young kids that we're raising, and this topic comes up. But it's also changing the frame of what a sexual relationship is. It's not playing chess. It's not going to a basketball game. We have to set the context of what sexual relationship is and when it becomes appropriate. And having finding that with your kids early on, I think, is important so they can separate this act versus other acts that they're more familiar with.
Yeah, and you actually get sort of two kind of ideas related to the sex act. One idea, well, it's just fun, enjoy it. And the other idea is, well, no, there's something much more serious going on in terms of the relationships and all. And it seems to me that America's sort of confused about that. A study is done which asks the question, do you think it is okay for two 18-year-olds to have sex with one another if they have a strong affection for each other? Not married. A majority of Americans, close to 70%, say yes, that's okay. You ask the question for 16-year-olds, and it's less than half of that. So at 16, no, it's not all right. 18, it's all right. It's sort of this mythical kind of 18. Somehow you turn 18, you become an adult. And it's still kind of, I mean, certain things, you're a legally adult when you turn 18. But there's the idea, somehow when you're 18, then you really can think for yourself. 16, no, but if it's just something which is fun, what's the problem with 16? Well, so it's playing with dynamite. I mean, it's, you know, 16-year-old, not quite sure, you know, this sex thing is potent. You know? So there's the realization that there really is some power to sex, more than just the physical pleasure involved in it. Even amongst the general population, although it gets confused that way, and the younger, sort of you do by all adults, the youngest grouping of adults are much more affirming of the 16-year-olds having sex than are those who are older. But even amongst them, once you get 18, it jumps up quite a bit in terms of the approval rating. Anything else? I was fascinated by it. I just had really enjoyed sort of surfing the internet and looking at these studies and finding out interesting facts. One thing to start off with, in talking about the topic of sex or sexuality with anyone, we need a tremendous amount of grace. Whether or not they're sexually involved with someone else, to challenge them on that, that's very emotionally personal. And we need to recognize that Jesus, we need a tremendous amount of compassion and tenderness as we talk about these things. Jesus, I think, is a good example. Now, most people agree that this sexual story is not in the original Gospel of John, but it fits with the character of Jesus, the story of a woman caught in adultery. And the question of Jesus, shall we stone her, as the Old Testament law says? Well, it's a question, where's the man? If you caught her in adultery, why are there two of you here? But at any rate, Jesus tittles in the ground or something, we're not sure what he's doing, and he says, he is without sin, cast the first stone. And one by one, they all leave, and the woman is there by herself, and Jesus says, does no one accuse you? And they say, no, they've left. And Jesus says to her, neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more. So Jesus isn't saying there was nothing wrong with it. What she did was wrong, regardless of what sort of circumstances she might come up with. It's a sin. And we need that kind of compassion. Go and sin no more. Not railing against a person because of what they've done. It's, we just need a tremendous amount of grace in that. Now, I have a conviction about God's commands. The God's commands are not arbitrary, they're for the overall good. So when God gives commands, I don't think it's simply, well, I want to see how obedient you are. So he'll give you this arbitrary command and just see how much you're willing to obey me, even when you don't want to. Now, there is some element in terms of learning obedience through obeying God's commands, but I believe God's commands are actually for our good or for the greater good. It's not necessarily for one's individual good, but it's for the greater good. So God calls us to make sacrifices for others, the larger picture than just ourselves. But if it's the case that God's commands are actually for human flourishing and for the flourishing of his creation, in most instances, we should be able to discover by reflecting why, in fact, this does contribute to human flourishing. After all, at least we have somewhat of an idea of what contributes or takes away from our own flourishing. So we should be able, in most instances, to be able to look at God's command and say, okay, I can begin to see that. Now, I don't think we should expect that we'll understand all of God's commands in that way, because our perspective is limited. Plus, we're culturally influenced. So depending on your cultural influences, what you think is right may not actually be right, may not actually be for the greater good. But in most instances, you can. So I'm starting with this, the expectation, when I think about God's commands with regard to sexuality, that we should be able to make sense of them just in human terms. But no guarantee about that, should be able to. Here's a statement about what biblical view of sex, and I'll just state it here, and I won't say much about it, but sex is solely to be within the marital bond that unites a man and a woman in a lifelong love that brings them together into a complementary whole, a whole that reflects the union of Christ with his church and that provides a setting within which children can be raised and receive the complementary nurturing of a father and mother. So if you want to ask me about that, you can later on, but I thought it helpful to just sort of put that up front. Okay, understanding why. Why is it that God says Sex is only within the marriage relationship. Guns have four non-religious reasons. The first one, oxytocin. I mentioned earlier the oxytocin is a hormone that's released in the brain when people are affectionate with each other, but in a much greater way in the lead up to sex and the sex act itself. So I sometimes say the oxytocin is the chemical reason why casual sex hurts. You might think, well, if two people are both agreed that this is non-committal, let's just have sex for the fun of it. If they're both agreed to that, what's the harm? Well, the harm is that if they have sex more than just once, maybe a one-night stand, you don't develop much of an emotional bond with the person. But if you're having sex several times or more with an individual, oxytocin will be creating an emotional bond between yourself and that person. And lo and behold, what you thought was just going to be for the fun of it, you break it off and it hurts. They didn't intend it, but we're actually wired chemically that when we're having sex, that builds an emotional bond with a person. And to think I can do it without having any effects of it doesn't make sense. I've actually read some things about hookups, sort of you're having sex just for the fun of it. And several people say, you don't want to have hookups with someone you like. It ought to be with someone that you enjoy the sex, but never would this person be a person you go out to coffee with. So you distance yourself as much as possible so this emotional bond is minimized because you have no commitment there. But if you really like the person, oh, that can cause problems. You have a question back there?
No.
No, okay, all right. Psychology Today, on one of their websites, Psych Basics, what is oxytocin? Oxytocin is a powerful hormone. When we hug or kiss a loved one, oxytocin levels drive up. It also acts as a neurotransmitter in the brain. In fact, the hormone plays a huge role in pair bonding. Prairie voles, one of nature's most monogamous species, produce oxytocin in spades. This hormone is also greatly stimulated during sex, birth, breastfeeding, and the list goes on. Now, I want to insert here that oxytocin is released both in the brains of men and in women. But for women, there's about twice as much oxytocin gets released within men. So women develop what's happening in their brain, they develop the emotional bond faster than men do. Now, obviously, if a guy has been in a relationship, they break it off, it hurts for the guy as well. It sounds like guys are immune to breakups. But it affects emotionally women typically more than men. And that'll come out in some of the studies that are looked at. There's a movie which I don't recommend seeing. I haven't seen it, but Tom Cruise plays a playboy in this movie, and he's had sex with this woman and then drops her. And the woman says to him, "Don't you know that when you sleep with somebody, your body makes a promise whether you do or not?" Interesting comment in a totally secular movie. But what's said here is that, yes, when you have sex, it's more than just a sexual act. There's a bonding which is taking place, and this is saying your body makes a promise whether you do or not. There is that power to sex. The next non-religious reason is that there are two ideas in tension which are quite common. Both of them are common amongst the same people. One is sex for the fun of it before marriage is okay. Or I might say not just for the fun of it, but if you like someone. Not just anybody, but if you like someone, then it's okay to have sex with a person without any commitment for marriage. So before you get married, you can have sex with a variety of people. No, that's okay. Just be careful. The other idea is that once you get married, you are to be faithful to that person, only have sex with that individual. You don't have sex with anybody else. But when you walk down the aisle and you say, "I do," your brain doesn't flip a switch from singleness mode to married mode. And the mode that they had before in terms of this kind of behavior and their ease of going into that doesn't just disappear once they get married. So it becomes much more difficult to maintain this sex only to the one you're with. Interesting enough, I was reading that amongst heterosexuals, when they're in a sexual relationship with someone else, homosexuals, it's much less so. But amongst heterosexuals, if you're having sex with somebody, you shouldn't be having sex with somebody else at the same time. Even if it's just for a few months you're with this person, You're only with that person. So it's sort of a serial monogamy in the dating relationship. When you're having sex with someone, only that person. And oftentimes your relationship will break off if one has sex with somebody else. Oh, there's no marriage here, but you know, somehow you can't have sex with anybody else. So there's this idea that it should be sexually exclusive when you're sexually involved with someone. And clearly when you get married, the idea is it'll be exclusive. Now it's worth noting that, yeah, Peter.
King Solomon, the wisest man on earth.
Yeah, a wise man, but even wise men make some foolish choices. And when you look at the consequences of polygamy in the Bible, I mean, yes, why is it that Absalom, who goes against his father, basically usurping the throne? Well, I suspect a good part of that reason is he didn't see very much of Absalom growing up. Because he had a number of wives, he probably didn't see Absalom very often. And the one person that Absalom did have close contact with was his mother. And you get all these problems that come from it. So even though it's not prohibited in the Old Testament, clearly all the consequences of polygamy are negative. When it comes to Jesus is quite clear that monogamy was God's original intention. But notice amongst these two ideas, if you ask, what's more important for my long-term well-being? My own sense of flourishing in my life, happiness in the broad sense of that. Clearly, it's going to be much more important that you find someone that you marry, if you get married, and that relationship be a stable, healthy relationship. That's going to make a huge difference in sort of the life in terms of your own welfare and well-being. If, however, the first value undercuts the second one, which it does, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go for short-term gratification when it undercuts your long-term well-being. Just think about self-interest. I mean, now, not saying that when you have sex with someone you're not married to, you're going to feel guilt. Some people feel guilt. Not everybody feels guilt about it. But you're going for short-term gratification, but you ought to recognize that actually is making it more difficult to have the long-term well-being that you want. So it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. As I said one time in a conversation, this is rather stupid. My wife said, don't say stupid, because after all, this person might, that you're talking to, be in a sexual relationship. Just use the word stupid. I just shouldn't do that. You have to have grace. So using the word stupid, but it's not rational. So that's a little bit more toned down. the next point is there's a strong societal need for controls on sex. And when you ask, well, why is this? Well, one might say, well, society ought to be reinforcing good moral standards. Well, from a Christian standpoint, that can make some sense. But from a standpoint of society that's no longer Christian, why is it that society or the law or the state should care about what two people do in a bedroom? I mean, why should that make a big difference to them? Well, I suggest that, well, maybe it doesn't make a big difference to the state from that standpoint. But it is very important to the state that children grow up and become emotionally well-balanced and they become good citizens. So there's a very strong state interest in the upbringing of children. But if the upbringing of children, the most important influence in their lives are typically their parents, then you want that child-parent relationship to be as good as possible. And if, in fact, as I've been arguing, that having sex before marriage undercuts that marriage relationship, then the state actually has some reason for encouraging people to wait until they get married for having sex simply for the raising of children. The parents need to love each other, and it needs to be a permanent relationship in terms of the well-being of the children, and without sex with anyone else. When I was in college, there was a book called Open Marriage. And this couple were basically having, you can be married, but why have it be closed marriage? It's okay if you both agree to it, you can have sex with other people. Well, a number of years later, this couple got divorced. And when you have sex with someone else, that builds a bond with that person and probably decreases the bond between the two of you. So it's typical, you start having sex outside, that the marriage is in trouble. Although, if you're in a situation where you find yourself with that, you need grace. Everyone can be forgiven by God, and we should be willing to forgive a spouse. People can turn and find forgiveness from God and forgiveness from each other. The next one, the negative personal impact on casual sex. By personal, I mean both your own sense of well-being and also personal relationships. If you're having trouble in your marriage, that has a strong negative effect on your own personal well-being. I've never known anybody that's going through a breakup of marriage that, my life is fine. No, it's not. This very crucial relationship in your life is not going fine. And so the question is, what's the negative personal impact, apart from just the reasons that I've given? And I'm going to look at some psychological studies, which I find quite interesting. The first one, done in 2010, published in the Journal of Family Psychology, an article about it in WebMD. The article in WebMD was entitled, Benefits in Delaying Sex Until Marriage, Happier Marriages, More Satisfying Sex, Among the Perks Study Finds. Interesting title for an article. The study involved over 2,000 married participants, so it was a pretty big study. The majority of the couples had sex within 2 months of starting to date, which is eye-opening to me. I know a lot of people have sex early on, but a majority of these 2,000 had sex within the first 2 months after dating. In fact, I've come to realize that dating, in many people's minds, well, if you're dating, you have sex. And if you've been dating for several months, you haven't had sex, well, why not? You're dating, aren't you? So in the popular mind, it's okay to have sex if you're dating. I mean, why wait very long? And the majority of people in the study had sex within the first 2 months. 16% delayed intercourse until marriage. According to the study, people who waited until marriage rated sexual quality 15% higher than people who had premarital sex. They rated relationship stability at 22% higher. They rated satisfaction with their relationships 20% higher. So in all these various ways, the marriage relationship was better because they'd waited. And again, if that's what matters long term, do what you can to support that. Don't do things which will undercut that relationship. Then they added the benefits are about half as strong for couples who became sexually active later in their relationships but before marriage. So suppose they're dating for 6 months and they start having sex together. And there are a lot of people who get engaged and then have sex together. If they wait before they start having sex for a long period of time, the negative effects are not as large, or the difference between early sex and waiting until marriage, or the sort of in-between point. So if you wait longer, that's better, but the best actually is to wait until you get married. The study, and this is from WebMD, the study shows that couples who wait until marriage are happier with the quality of sex than couples who have intercourse before their vows. What's more, couples who delay sex until their wedding night have more stable and happier marriages than couples who have premarital sex. The author, Dean Busby, writes, regardless of religiosity, waiting helps the relationship form better communication processes, and these help improve long-term stability and relationship satisfaction. So if you're having sex with someone, or even if you're not having sex, but you get in this hot and heavy, if that's your sort of mode that you're into with the person you're dating, you're probably not spending a whole lot of time in quality communication. Plus, there's the difficulty that if you're in this hot and heavy relationship, whether or not you're actually having sexual intercourse, there's an emotional bond which is developing through oxytocin. And you're asking the question, well, is this the right person? Well, it becomes much harder to know, is this the right person, because there's an emotional bond which is developing through the sexual side of your relationship. Whereas if you wait on that and you find there's a strong bond developing in the person, that's because of other things about the person. So it's much easier to know if this is the right person. There's a very common today for people to think, well, if you live with your boyfriend and girlfriend before you get married to test it out, that's a good idea. Because then you'll know from firsthand experience what it's like. And if you get married, then your marriage is much more apt to succeed and you're much less likely to get a divorce. Actually, the implications are the opposite. There are various reasons why people start living together, but if they live together to test the relationship, that's one of the worst outcomes in terms of the relationship between each other and the divorce rate. It's exactly the opposite. Even though people think that is a good strategy for finding the right person, live together so you'll know whether or not this person is the right person. When I looked at this, I noticed that Dean Busby, the author of the study, is a professor at Brigham Young University, which is a Mormon university. So I thought to myself, if I were not a Christian or I didn't agree with what Dean Busby was saying, I say this question, this study, I got to see other studies. Well, actually, there are other studies. I mean, when a person is biased, it doesn't mean that the study results aren't legitimate. So that's what questions are asked and how people respond. But at the same time, I had this sort of question. It's important that there are other studies that come up with the same kinds of results. So there's a study in 2012, again published in the Journal of Family Psychology, done by Cornell University. And it was analyzing data from a 2006 marital relationship survey, broad survey. And it was reported in the Cornell Chronicle in 2012. So from the Cornell Chronicle, quote, women who have sex early in a relationship are more likely to be dissatisfied with the quality of the relationship. So I've already seen that. Men who delayed sex also reported having higher levels of commitment and less conflict. But the effect was greater for women. So for the men, you're more apt to feel about a commitment with this person if you wait than if you don't. In fact, oftentimes when a man has sex with a woman, his view of her actually goes down rather than going up. Women oftentimes think, if I want to find a husband, then I need to have sex with this person because then he'll like me. Actually, it doesn't. You're not at all guaranteeing it. And women oftentimes get treated worse when they give in too easily to the request to have sex. Early sex in a relationship was also associated with living together sooner and less satisfying marriages. The author Sharon Sasser writes, regardless of its cause, sex early on in a relationship may have lasting effects on the quality of that relationship. There's another study done in 2014, it's entitled Before I Do, University of Virginia, the National Marriage Project, reported in the campus paper. I want to say about this is a longitudinal study. So if a study takes a group of people, ask a bunch of questions, wait some years, come back at the same group of people, the question is how have things changed? It's called a longitudinal over time. And this was that kind of a study. So the study starts with unmarried couples already in a sexual relationship, and the focus is the effect of one versus multiple sexual relationships on marriage in the future. So they start off with people already in a sexual relationship, come back 5 years later, and find out how many of these people are married and what are the consequences. So this initial study was 2007-2008 with close to 1,300 unmarried Americans between 18 and 34. In the next 5 years, 418 of these recruited individuals had gotten married. So the researchers went back to these 418 and asked them questions. It says, according to the study, men and women who had premarital sex with only their future spouse, so the baseline was they're already in a sexual relationship, if they only had sex with their future spouse, they report having a stronger relationship than those who did not. Additionally, women who had fewer sexual partners prior to marriage reported having higher marriage quality. So the more sexual partners you have, the worse the effect on the long-term outcome. Then it says the order in which couples move through relationship stages, such as cohabitation or having children, can also impact marriage success. According to the study, those who unintentionally cross these relationship milestones have lower marriage quality than couples who decide on their relationship sequence together. Now you might think, well, if two people are living together, don't they decide to live together? Well, in one sense, obviously they decide to live together, but is it something they thought very much about? These days, it's so easy and common for people to live together. Well, if it's financially convenient, all right, we'll do it. Or if they're in a dating relationship and she's already oftentimes going over to his apartment or vice versa, well, why travel back? Why just live together since we're seeing each other fairly frequently? So they sort of slip into it rather than actually having decided to live together. And when those kinds of decisions are made, just sliding into it, the outcomes are much worse than if people carefully deliberate about the steps that they're taking. And people recognize that choosing to live together actually is a huge decision. You may not think of it as being huge, and society doesn't think of it as being huge. And when you hear two people are living together, you have no clue as to whether they ever intend to get married or whether it's just for financial reasons or whatever. But it actually makes a big difference, their motivation when they move in together. It's discovered that if people are living together and they intend to get married, the consequences are about the same for people who are in a sexual relationship with each other but aren't living together. If, however, I said if they're living together to test the relationship, then that's bad for the consequences. If they're living together and they're even actually engaged, but they still intend to get married, the consequences aren't huge compared to people who are in a sexual relationship without living together. But if, in fact, there's an asymmetry between the two of them, where one of them is starting to think, well, I'd like to have this lead to marriage, and the other is noncommittal, that's the worst outcome. If you're testing it and trying to figure out whether it works, that's a very bad idea, and all the studies indicate that it's a very bad idea. There is a book published in 2011 by Oxford University Press by Mark Regnerus and Jeremy Uecker, Premarital Sex in America, How Young Americans Meet, Mate, and Think About Marrying. So here is the New York Times reporting on it. The research, which looks at sexual behavior among contemporary young adults, finds a significant correlation between sexual restraint and emotional well-being, between monogamy and happiness, and between promiscuity and depression. The correlation is much stronger for women than for men. Female emotional well-being seems to be tightly bound to sexual stability, which may help explain why overall female happiness has actually drifted downward since the sexual revolution. I have the book, I've been reading it, but I haven't sort of gotten to how he makes this case. But it's an interesting comment because in many ways the position of women has significantly improved since the 1960s is typically where people start counting the sexual revolution. I mean, women have a much easier time getting into positions of employment, getting the same pay as men would get, a whole variety of things. But if it's actually the case that women overall are less happy now than they were before the sexual revolution, it means that the sexual revolution has had a bad effect on women generally. Okay, and then it goes on and says, among the young people Regnerus and Uecker studied, the happiest women were those with a current sexual partner and only one or two partners in their lifetime. Virgins were almost as happy, though not quite. That's an interesting comment to me. Because sometimes women think, if only I get married, I'd be happy. But actually, marriage is as significant as sex is in building a relationship, and as valuable as it is to be in a marriage relationship. I mean, most of us really do desire eventually to get married, and most non-Christians eventually desire to get married and settle down and have this deep relationship with one person. But the sexual part of that, being married, actually is not the most important thing about your own personal happiness. Your own personal happiness has much to do with relationships of trust and friendships, and also a sense of meaning and purpose in your life. And so women who have that, but aren't married, even if they'd like to be married, okay, they're a little bit less happy overall, but it's not as though they're in the pits. So don't despair. It says, and then a young woman's likelihood of depression rose steadily as her number of partners climbed and the present stability of her sex life diminished. Okay, what the studies tell us, sort of in summary. Waiting until marriage is not an old-fashioned idea based on the danger of having unwanted pregnancy. Opting for short-term pleasure now is likely to have negative effect on long-term happiness for oneself and for the couple. Even if one eventually marries the sexual partner, the premarital sex can have a negative effect on the marriage relationship. Let me insert here that there are quite a few Christian couples who are engaged, who are having sex before they get married. And often, well, what's wrong with that? They're going to get married. Well, it's not certain you're going to get married. Okay, even though you're engaged, there are a fair number of engaged couples that do break things off and don't actually get married. So it's not absolutely certain that if you're engaged, you're going to be getting married. But there's benefits in waiting. So if I haven't actually had this opportunity yet, but if I met a couple who's a Christian couple and I find out they're having sex with each other and they're engaged, I would recommend to them that they stop. I mean, suppose the wedding date is 2.5 months down the road. If they stop and don't have sex again until they get married, there could be a couple benefits. One will be that wedding night will actually be significant to them. It won't just be, well, we were with each other earlier in the week and now we're here again and now we have this marriage license. Rather, it will mean something. It'll be communicating that there's this bond, that the sex act actually is going to communicate something, whereas without waiting, it didn't. Plus, if they wait, it builds trust in the relationship. If either of them is on a business trip and, say, the wife sees some old boyfriend, what's she going to do? Or the man is on a business trip and he gets propositioned by someone, what's he going to do? If, in fact, they know that they both had the discipline of waiting, even though they had sex before, waiting until they got married, that builds trust in the relationship. So don't think sort of virginity or not, that's it. If you lost your virginity, then you've lost it. It doesn't really matter what you do. No, that's not the case. There's wisdom in stopping and realigning yourself to be in line with God's pattern. And there's grace in that, and there's significant benefit to be had from it. So benefits of waiting. Some further reflections. Physical expressions of affection and love can express growing love and commitment. So, for instance, suppose you are getting to know a girl and you take the person's hand, you're walking down the sidewalk. What are you communicating to each other by the fact that you're walking down the sidewalk hand in hand? It's not just, oh, your fingers are fidgety and you wanted to hold on to someone. No, it's actually communicating to the person, I care for you, you are special. So what does the physical expression of the relationship, if you wait, not just simply in terms of the sexual intercourse itself, but if those things actually reflect where you are in your relationship, it's effective communication. If it's just verbal, people can say things that the other person wants to hear, but the physical affection actually communicates stronger than the verbal affection does, and there's that capacity for that. But if you go all the way early on, then you don't, the physical possibilities for communication are lost. Physical expressions of affection, not just sex, can push a relationship too fast. So people are feeling, well, we've been doing everything but, or we've gone all the way, well, we should probably get married, right? It can push the relationship faster than you want to push it. When Janet, my wife, and I were dating each other, or we were seeing each other, I wasn't all sure at that point whether I want to get married. But we've been showing a lot of affection towards each other, and I felt like, you know, this is communicating to her that I'm very open to where this relationship would go, and I don't know. What I'm physically expressing is not sure where I'm at. So we talked about that and tried to figure out some ways in which we could make it clear as the relationship grew when, in fact, we were open towards marriage as a possibility. Healthy relationships need lots of communication. So Dean Busby mentioned that. If you're in communication with other people, if you're sexually deeply involved with the other person, regardless whether it's sexual intercourse, that takes away from the communication. And just lots and lots of need for good communication, and sex gets in the way of that. Resisting future temptations when one is married is easier. I mentioned that. Trust between husband and wife is enhanced. I like this quote from Lauren Winter from a book called Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. Life lived inside the contours of God's law humanizes us and makes us beautiful. It makes us creatures living well in the created order. It gives us the opportunity to become who we're meant to be. Now, if you have a son or daughter and they come to the place where they actually can read this and say, yes, I agree with that, hooray. They've seen that God's way is actually for their flourishing, for them to lead, if they follow that, and that will be hugely important in terms of their being able to resist temptation. By the way, one thing I don't have on the slides, but pornography is a huge problem amongst Christian men, because after all, nobody sees. It's not as though, well, somebody see you out with such person, that kind of thing. Nobody sees it. But it has a very strong negative effect. It builds a fantasy life in men, and also men begin to view women as sexual objects. And when a person is stuck on pornography, it's very easy for this man's mind to go in the same direction when it comes to other women that he sees. And that's clearly not a good thing. When I was in university, there were some friends of mine who recognized they were struggling with pornography, or should be struggling with pornography, maybe weren't struggling as much as they, but they recognized that they needed to get away from it, and they would develop an accountability partners. And they would get together every week, and one question they would always ask, okay, how's the sexual side of things been going? And one person might say, well, I did well until Wednesday night. And they have to have compassion for each other, because after all, there's slippage and you fall. But nonetheless, you need that kind of support to help you follow God's guiding when there's motivation within you to want to push the button and to go to something you shouldn't be going to. One last thing I want to say before tying things up here is that what's the relationship? So the question is, what place does our sexuality and engaging in sex have or should it have in our personal identity? Now, most of us were clearly either a man or woman. Now, there are people who are confused about that, and it's not always their fault. So there's this, people have sort of confused sense of what sex am I. But the question is, how important should your own sexual identity be in your own personal identity? A common assumption today is that your sexuality and engaging in sex is so much a part of who you are that not to act on it is to deny who you are and live less than a fully realized life. And a person may give sort of an evolutionary explanation that evolution requires mating, and mating is what life is all about. So therefore, if you're not engaged in sex with someone, you're denying your biological nature. Well, it may be part of your biological nature, but it's not a crucial part of your psychological nature. You can refrain from having sex, and it's not going to distort your life or warp your life or make your life. No, if you're not having sex and you're choosing that, it's not as though your identity is being undercut. There's but as significant as your gender is and who you are, your identity ought to be in being a person and being loved by God. So where does my identity lie? It lies in my identity as a person more than my being a man, even though I'm a man. It identifies my being a person, and it lies in my relationship with God. And those are the things that ought to be crucial and central in our lives. A friend of mine passed on a link to a little video on YouTube where a Christian Anglican minister was speaking the platform to an assembly of Anglican ministers. So it was a ministerial meeting in the Anglican Church. And he said to everyone there that he, in fact, had homosexual orientations, that he'd had that for much of his life. But he says, I thank God that my identity does not lie in my sexuality. If my identity and meaning lay in my sexuality, then I would have to say that Christ missed out on a full, rich life because he was sexually abstained. But if Christ, in fact, did not miss out on a full, rich life, and he is our model, the fact that we abstain from something as much as we may desire as acting on our sexual orientations, that's not crucial to our identity. He says, I thank God that my identity does not lie in my sexual feelings, but it lies in Christ and how God views me as a person. He did say that my congregation doesn't have problems. I mean, very forthright with the congregation that he's a pastor over. So, but I do have a problem with many of you who, instead of accepting what I'm saying and encouraging me and supporting me, you belittle me. And even though as a group, they just recently passed a vote formally adopting the man and woman definition of marriage, and that many of them were in fact acting contrary to it. And he felt as though they as a community were far less supportive than his congregation was towards him. But anyway, this is not talking about homosexuality, but a little aside on that. So as good as sex is in a proper place, being sexually active ought not to be a fundamental part of our identity. Put another way, living a rich and fulfilling life does not depend on engaging in sex. Now, Dorothy Sayers wrote a number of sort of whodunit, sort of murder story kind of novels. But a number of books as well, wrote a little book entitled Are Women Human? And I love this little quotation from it. She says, a man once asked me how I managed in my books to write such natural conversation between men when they were by themselves. Was I by any chance a member of a large mixed family with a lot of male friends? I replied that on the contrary, I was an only child and had practically never seen or spoken to any men of my own age till I was about 25. Well, said the man, I shouldn't have expected a woman, meaning me, to have been able to make it so convincing. I replied that I coped with this difficult problem by making men talk, as far as possible, like ordinary human beings. This aspect of the matter seemed to surprise the other speaker. He said no more, but took it away to chew over it. One of these days, it may quite likely occur to him that women, as well as men, when left to themselves, talk very much like human beings also. So as much as people talk about how hugely important our sexuality is, yes, it permeates our lives, but our lives as persons are much more important. And a husband and wife, if they relate to each other as persons, the marriage will go well. Even if they're not all that great in the finessing the sexual sides of it, if they're personally connecting with each other and relating as persons, the marriage will be okay. Conclusion, when one gives into the pleasure of short-term sexual gratification apart from long-term commitment, one is acting contrary to one's long-term well-being and contrary to the long-term well-being of the relationship of the couple. Recognizing this may not be enough to withstand the temptation of the moment. The human mind quite readily justifies to itself any action towards which there is strong motivation. Lesson, be warned. When sexual attraction is in high gear, one's moral deliberations ought not to be trusted. So I said at the beginning, I talk about at the end of this talk in Luleå, Sweden, I said, even if you agreed with the studies and that made sense to you, there's a very good chance that you won't abide by, keep with what I'm saying. And the reason is that you'll likely find yourself with a man or woman, depending on who you are, and you'll like this person, and both of you will have a strong desire for sex. And if there's not religious reasons keeping you from having sex, you will likely, in your mind, convince yourself that surely it's okay. You might even be so sophisticated as to say, well, all these studies are statistical studies. It's not the case that everyone who has sex has these negative effects. It's just statistics. But you need to recognize that your mind has a great capacity to rationalize what you want. And in that case, in that situation, you very much want to have sex. The other person very much wants to have sex. And I almost guarantee you, your mind will convince you that it's all right. That you really love and care for each other. For you, it's surely fine, and it'll be fine for you. But you need to recognize that your brain is not thinking objectively at that point. Regardless of whether or not your brain was right, it's not thinking objectively, and don't trust it. So, but anyway, you'll probably slip into it. But if you don't, it'll be because you've already come to very strong convictions, and you do things to hold to that, even to fight the desires that you have. But again, there's a great need for exhibiting grace, as I said at the beginning. Okay, questions.
Getting back to the wisest man on earth. Ecclesiastes, he said he could trust one man in a thousand, but he could not trust a woman in a thousand. Which to me shows that he, in all his marriages, he never developed a close relationship to any of them.
Yeah, so again, the question about Solomon, who is the wisest man who ever lived.
Yeah.
Well, being the wisest man who ever does doesn't mean that he was the wisest in every respect.
That's right.
Very wise people can, through emotional desires, do stupid things. And given that back then kings had the sort of expectation, of course you can have lots of wives. Solomon did that, but in fact it was not a good thing. And after Solomon's death, there's the kingdom gets divided up.
Well, I think he was in effect admitting that it was a mistake by saying he could not develop a good relationship.
Yeah, so he couldn't develop a good relationship with him. And it's interesting that in the Quran, there's a statement that you could have more than one wife if you treat them equitably. But Muhammad actually came to realize he couldn't treat his own wives equitably. So he himself backpedaled on this insistence, marrying other people, you have to be able to treat them equitably. But anyway, that's a bit of an aside. Yes. Yeah, well, for one thing, throughout all of Scripture, you don't have sex until you're married, and the act of sex actually marries you. So having sex with a person, you're making that commitment. And if you don't follow through with that commitment, there can be consequences in terms of the Old Testament law. And there's a public ceremony when, in fact, the woman would move in with a man. And for the woman to have sex with the man before then was scandalous. So when Mary is pregnant, they don't say, oh, well, you didn't wait, did you, Joseph? No, the assumption is she had sex with somebody else because he obviously is not, because he is a righteous man. So there's that side of it. But also in terms of the biblical view of marriage, it's not simply two people being united together. So as Genesis says, the man leaves his father and mother and cleaves his wife, and the two become one flesh. Well, they become one flesh not only physically speaking, but also spiritually speaking. And it's not simply a spiritual union of the two of them, it's a union of them before God. And for us as Christians, it's a union within Christ. So a Christian marriage is just not two people meeting together, it's two people meeting in Christ. So they're being married in Christ, and it's under the umbrella of Christ, and Christ is in that relationship, which has a very different dynamic to a Christian sense of marriage than for a secular sense of marriage. So it's a very, very deep spiritual component. And Paul says that, in fact, the relationship of husband and wife is an illustration of God's love for us. The love that Christ had for his church, the husband is to have for his wife, and that is to, the marriage is to reflect that kind of self-giving love that Christ has towards us. So it has all these spiritual aspects to it, which non-Christians wouldn't see. But from a Christian standpoint, yeah, there are very definitely things which go beyond simply what can be given as secular reasons. Any other questions? Yes. Well, they hear the studies and they recognize that these aren't people who are already Christians. And even the U.S. with Christian kids having sex, it's interesting to me that if a person attends church regularly, they're more apt to stay a virgin. But if they've had sex, the likelihood they'll have more than one relationship actually is just as high amongst evangelicals as amongst the general population. And the explanation that I heard given was, well, in the evangelical context, you have men and women rubbing shoulders together all the time. And so there's a relationship developing. If you start slipping into that, it's very easy for it to go on from there, and it's easier for Christian men and women to find themselves in that relationship than for the secular ones who, how do I build this contact with a woman to have these relationships? But it's a huge temptation for Christians, and given the cultural context with which having sex is no big deal, and it's going to be hard for young people to decide that yes, in fact, what Scripture says makes good sense. And so part of my desire is that they would see it not just simply from a Christian standpoint, the spiritual aspect of it, but also see it just from the standpoint of the relationship with each other and your own personal well-being, that what the Scripture says actually makes very good sense. Maybe one more question before we break for lunch. Okay, let me say there's a clipboard in the back. If you'd like to have the PowerPoint, and there's some extra slides beyond this, if you'd like to have a copy of the PowerPoint, put your name and your email address down there. And if you don't want to continue getting updates, say my wife and I go to Europe every year and give updates on the talks and interactions that we have with people. But if you don't want that, you can get unsubscribe anytime. But if you'd like to have the PowerPoint, go ahead and put your name and email address down there, and I will see that it gets to you. So let me pray for us. We need to pray about a topic as vital and loaded as this one. Lord, I pray that you would help each one of us in our convictions to our faithfulness to you. And being married is not just simply for our own personal gratification, but it's a commitment that we've made for better, for worse. Lord, help us in our faithfulness to you, be faithful to others around us. And Lord, I pray that you would give us wisdom, not only in speaking to other Christians about this topic, but also to non-Christians, that we could help them begin to see a bit of the sense that your commands do make, that what you have said about sexuality and where it belongs actually does make good sense. And Lord, give us all grace as we do this, engage in these kind of interactions, because we need that so much. Amen.